when all you have is a search engine, everything looks like a database.
Man, I have like a cypherpunk hard on right now.
Privacy is nothing to be granted. Privacy is something you take yourself.
They've got the Mossad, the CIA, and Hillary Clinton behind them.
We're now beyond what the Stasi could even dream of.
Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Hello and welcome to Reality Exploit Roundtable episode 12. On this episode, we'll be talking about anticipatory computing, social media confusion, restricting the internet, and campaign data mining. My name is Voodoo, and I'll be your host and moderator for this episode. I've situated the roundtable in plain view of the world for this episode because windowless bunkers are for pussies. Let's meet our panelists. First up, the guy who played the guy who played Halfsack on the Sons of Anarchy, Plato.
Yo.
Next, the man who puts the self in self-radicalization, Wise Guy.
Huh?
Fresh from an extended sabbatical where he studied under Moloch, Hero White.
Hello, everybody.
And the man that street people call King, Smuggler.
Yups.
In the midst of cyber Frankenstorms and Bronco Obama fatigue, we're going straight into our first topic. MindMeld listens to you and finds what you need. ARS Technica recently highlighted MindMeld, an iOS app expected to launch this fall that attempts to provide context to human conversations. Quote, MindMeld is an information-driven application which listens into your conversation and attempts to understand what's being said. Once it figures out what you're talking about, MindMeld will try to create a model of the conversation's context, and from that, it will attempt to locate and display relevant information from many different sources. Here's Expect Labs founder Tim Tuttle at TechCrunch Disrupt explaining MindMeld.
At first glance, this may seem a little bit like Skype meets Siri, but let me tell you about the technology that makes this far more powerful. We call it our anticipatory computing engine, and it goes well beyond simple voice search. What this platform is designed to do is analyze the last 10 minutes of your conversation so it can predict what you need in the next 10 seconds. We do this by developing a model of what your conversation is about that changes from second to second, and then we proactively find information from your social graph and the web and display it for you, in some cases before you need to ask for it.
Plato, there are some really neat use cases for this technology, and I think in maturity it's going to be a good tool to increase productivity. However, let's say you're the security consultant to Expect Labs. What risks would Plato Security Group warn them about?
So Expect Labs, they got to keep both their users and themselves in mind when they're developing a security model. So my first concern is that this is too much data. It's scary that every word you speak into your iPhone is going to be sent into some database somewhere and data mined by Expect Labs. So I would advise them to save as little data as possible to make their algorithms work and for as short a time as possible. And I mean, I understand they're going to need to keep some historical data so they understand contexts and they know like your favorite bars and stuff. But they might not need to save every single sentence you utter. So I would tell them to limit that. Obviously, make sure that their transport is secured against man-in-the-middle attacks. So when the iPhone is talking to their servers, you want to make sure that that connection is secure. And that might be kind of tricky because these recent SSL certificate spoofing attacks, we've seen that even SSL isn't necessarily totally secure. Another risk would be that some sort of iOS malware could be able to listen in and access the data that Expect and MindMeld is sending to the app. And I mean, I guess a malware would probably be able to listen to the microphone anyway, but it could also listen in and get all this handy information, and the malware wouldn't have to parse your sentence. It would just read the data that's being sent across the wire, and it would see, oh, hey, he's going to this place. And finally, Voodoo, you've talked about a protocol called Negative Acknowledge with regards to VPNs, and the idea there is that every day your VPN sends you an email that says, "You are not under subpoena. We are not under duress." And if perchance the government says, hey, we want to have all the records that you have on this guy and all future data. And by the way, you're not allowed to tell them that this subpoena exists. They can simply stop sending that email. And once you don't get that, you realize that there may be a problem and you might want to limit your access to this service. So they could implement some similar program for users who are concerned about privacy. Although I guess most people who are concerned about privacy would probably simply just not use this.
Yeah, Smuggler, I wasn't able to find out much about the architecture of MindMeld, and when he was asked at TechCrunch, Tim Tuttle kind of dodged the question. But let's just go ahead and assume that to do the audio and video, the transmission or the routing and the peer discovery, that it's going to have to go through some third-party server, whether it's Expect Labs or some Apple server or whatever, and that they're also going to be doing the search and the data aggregation at that same point, at that server. Doesn't that mean that the voice transmission is going to have to be in the clear and not encrypted?
Well, I'm pretty sure that they will do the voice analysis on their own servers in the cloud. And between them and the mobile device, the connection might be encrypted or might be not encrypted. But in the end, they will end up with having most of the voice and most of the narrative stream that is generated from the voice. And as I see most of the companies in that area right now, they will also do the analysis and context matching on their own machines, which means they will probably send all kinds of stuff from your mobile phone to their servers and then do the big chunking there.
So, but that's going to make it completely unusable for enterprise use, for enterprise conversations, and that doesn't that cut them out of the space completely?
No, I don't think so, because for an enterprise to use something, it's not about objective security, but it's about if you have been audited licenses and following the right ISO standards. So I do think that there will be corporations that do not think for more than 2 seconds about it when they're presented with the license. As you can see with so many other technologies out there, they're used by the corporations and the corporations trust the law.
Hero, do these security audits, will they keep up with this? Because this sounds like a Rosetta Stone for corporate espionage and government espionage to me. You're going to have voice and video transmitted in the clear to these servers and then out to the different participants in the conference call. And then on top of that, you're going to have the context of the data that's being collected along with this. As far as I'm concerned, you don't even need to be a party to the conversation. You just need to look at the data and you'll be able to figure out the entire conversation, won't you?
Yeah, exactly. Currently, though, if you look at many of the laws that are out there for many countries and policies for many corporations, they're already recording all email conversations and chat conversations, and many of them are doing this by law. So by the fact of using a system like this, some of the auditing that may be taking place is will not necessarily be an auditing for security privacy, but will be an audit to make sure that everything that is transferred is being recorded and stored. Another aspect you brought up, the corporate thing, is that many corporations out there have laws or policies where they are required to they're not allowed to use cloud services. So, I mean, there's a big chunk of this market that would never be using a remote service at all unless these people started providing in-house licensing systems for, you can get your own servers and your own software. But yeah, it's a complete whole open, what you call the ultimate type of data mine. I mean, they're doing all the analytics for you. So I can see that a company like this is if they don't already have somebody on their board of directors or who has contacted them, I'm sure that there's been security issues that have been brought up. But as soon as these guys go live, I mean, they're going to be getting they're going to have to provide for law enforcement just like all the other big corporations like, Gmail and Skype and the rest of these, where they essentially have in-house wiretap system. So you just, you know, connect and instantaneously you have, you know, an instant wiretap to anything that's happening for whatever their policy is to provide that. It's kind of crazy when you think of people just using this and not thinking anything of it.
Hero, you mentioned that corporations and agencies are already archiving all the emails and chat messages. But, I mean, this is obviously taking it a step further by, well, at least potentially archiving voice communications as well. And my concern is that, you know, I'll be talking to some guy on the street or the guy in the next cubicle, and he's got his iPhone on, and unbeknownst to me, now I'm in the database.
Yeah, that's a good point. Similar to how people taking photos we talked about before and posting them online, and you happen to be on the side of the picture and getting tagged. Yeah, that's something else. Somebody could really set up some type of a bug system. The police can just tie in their wiretaps that they're and their bugs that they have placed around on people. They just like plug it into the system and let the system do the analytics for them.
For that matter, I mean, they can just put it in the surveillance cams. I mean, they already have microphones. If you hooked all the world's surveillance cameras or even all of New York City's surveillance cameras into this this type of analytics system, you would have an unprecedented idea of everything going on.
I think you consider this system, when it becomes operational, if it becomes ubiquitous, as a privacy original sin.
Well, let's kind of ignore that for a second and talk straight cost-benefit-wise, guy, because if you watch the video of this thing, it is really neat. The fact that you can that it automatically brings up information on the different people on the conference call, you know, their Facebook profiles, all that stuff, and whoever you talk about, it brings up information on them, locations that you talk about, and then you can drag and drop and share those to a shared folder where everybody on the conference call can see that. I think that's a real benefit. I think that this would be a huge productivity tool, but we've talked about the costs of switching from one comms platform, say Skype, to another comms platform in previous roundtables, and we said that benefit has to exceed that cost. In this case, is the benefit going to exceed that cost?
Well, that is a good question. I think that for companies that don't have a huge following, or you know, they haven't implemented this infrastructure to any one particular platform, then yeah, it'll probably be easy. But if they've got in-house solutions or they've got custom solutions that they've rolled themselves, then it's probably going to be an expensive cost.
You know, that brought up a good point. Smuggler, maybe you could comment on this. I could see the release of this being something more of a boon to intelligence agencies and police systems throughout the world who would have the system tied in with their own custom databases. So while they're watching, while they're talking about suspects or looking at this and pulling things up, it's actually doing all this information with their, like I said earlier, we're joking around with their wiretaps, but I could see this as a custom thing for these organizations, aside from some, you know, a guy using it himself with the public cloud system.
Well, context analysis and pulling out context and topics or subjects from conversation, from voice conversation, has been in the toolkit of intelligence agencies for quite some while now. I still remember being on a trade fair in 1999, I think, where we visited a company that exactly does this. There's one part that does this transcription and the other part pulls out the ontological data. So that is nothing really new, but putting something like this on a global scale, you know, having lots of people voluntarily sharing all kinds of information and speaking to the thing will result in the models being much more precise. The machines learn, so to speak, from the amount of data that is coming in. And I think the models might be a good business in the future to sell to all kinds of people.
Well, and not only do the machines learn, but Tuttle specifically said that the users can provide feedback on the context that the machine's coming up with, whether or not those are good data that it's coming up with. Hero, I like your idea of the in-house servers. I think that's the way this company needs to go. Otherwise, they're not going to have any sort of security on this. And, of course, then in-house servers gets past the warrantless wiretapping.
Oh, yeah, and then that would also plug into all the local and federal agencies at all the different levels being able to plug this into their own databases for their own local analysis, and that opens up troves of billions of dollars coming in from anywhere from Homeland Security and everywhere into these custom systems.
Well, yeah, if the company servers are being used, but if you're doing it on an in-house server, then a lot of that traffic analysis and even the fact that who's on the conversation won't be known outside of the in-house network.
Yeah.
You won't believe how many appliances phone home.
Yeah. Hey, let's move on to social media. It's kind of confusing. Okay, according to Wired's Danger Room blog, an assessment of terrorism advisory organization inside the U.S. Army called the Asymmetric Warfare Group in 2011 listed some warning signs that a coworker may be about to go postal. Signs that you've turned into a terrorist who will soon kill your coworkers include recently changing your choices in entertainment, having peculiar discussions, complaining about bias, being socially withdrawn, and frustrated with mainstream ideologies. Your risk factors for radicalization include social networks and youth. Oh, man, they had me until the whole social networks and youth thing. Meanwhile, Facebook's plan is to get its next billion users revolves around convincing current and potential users that Facebook is the internet, a la AOL. In developing countries, Facebook applications are being packaged on SIM cards, text-only versions are available for feature phones, and, of course, Facebook Mobile is available for smartphones. Hero, we've talked on the roundtable before about how not having social media accounts is considered suspicious by two potential employers. And social media and the widgets used on social media seem to be driving all of the development these days, pushing more and more people towards Facebook. Is the Army assessment completely at odds, is the panel out of step, or do they really think that everybody using these things is a potential terrorist?
I didn't read the actual report by the Army, but I did read through the Wired article and have seen a couple other comments on this. And I think that when you look at what they're scanning for, they're essentially scanning for nonconformity. Anybody who steps out of line from normal types of usage. So that's not something that is going to indicate that someone is a terrorist. But it puts you on the radar of this guy does not have the same patterns that we're seeing from other people. It's similar to the spending patterns when a bank needs to finds that, you know, there's an irregular transaction that takes place that's not normal for this person's activity or their particular profile. And when you see what they're doing, they're looking for these types of things. But again, they're not necessarily looking for someone who says, ask a question about like the one example they gave with the guy from Texas where he actually had emailed about the morality of killing Americans. They're not scanning for particular types of keywords. They're actually looking for information on people who are using these systems in ways that are not they're nonconformist to how regular patterns of usage are going. And that can be anybody who that can put you a flag up on you, even if you're very upset about something that the local government is doing, and you're being some type of activist or something. So as long as the majority of people out there at a certain level are generally towing particular lines, then you're not going to be, you know, you're not going to be outside the radar. But as soon as you start doing some of this other stuff, you pop up on the screen. I think that there is something to what they're looking for, and I think it's false to say that you're going to find a terrorist. But you will find people who are not talking about the normal things that normal people are supposedly mainstream people who are just swallowing everything and then spitting it back out. You'll come up, and this is a good way to see those people.
You mean people like us?
People like you.
Yeah, even capital L libertarians and other people. I mean, you're sticking your head up.
This is right out of the Eagles lyrics for On the Border.
Well, what about that, wise guy? The description of the report, at least to me, sounded exactly like when someone commits suicide, everyone who ever had contact with that person suddenly looks back and goes, oh, you know what? I hadn't talked to him in 2 years. That was a sign. Or, you know, boy, he didn't show up for lunch, and so I missed that sign. And they manufacture all these things that, oh, these are signs that we missed. Isn't that really what this report is doing? It's just going, hey, look, we've had these fragging incidents, and these are things that went on, but they may or may not be signs. They were just normal things that they're attributing some sort of import to.
Well, exactly. I think that in life, most of the things that go on around us have a high noise-to-signal ratio. They're looking to find some kind of particular behaviors in which they consider that a signal. And unfortunately, it's only in hindsight that one can say which things were important, which were signals and which were noise. And it's different in every situation. I don't think that they're going to be able to use this system to really find much of any quote-unquote terrorists, but they will use it in a 1984-type fashion to see who's not really grasping newsthink or newspeak and who's thinking outside the norm.
I think exactly what Wise Guy says. I mean, that's exactly the point. It's not about catching terrorists, but it's more about making people used to a certain frame of behavior. And as you all know, your actions change your psyche. So behave like the government wants to, and you become a little slave that is actually happy.
Hey, Plato, the Facebook as the internet meme is interesting to me. Because I see, I do recognize the pipelining that's going on. How pipelined is the World Wide Web right now? Because that's what we're talking about, not the internet, the World Wide Web. How pipelined is it, and where is it heading?
Well, I guess you could say that right now, I mean, pretty much everything on the web is, well, I mean, it's obviously interconnected. Whatever site you go to, you're still talking to your ISP, and it's going along their pipeline or their backbones and across the same wires on the internet. Across the same undersea cables. As far as this Facebook goes, they are certainly trying to get ubiquitous and make sure that every person in the world has heard of Facebook, and if they're not on Facebook, they, you know, feel bad about it. I don't know. The trend I see is that Facebook's going to keep trying to do this because it's more money for them and more users. But I do certainly hope that we see alternatives popping up. Stuff like what's that? There's some Diaspora, something like Diaspora, but a bit better.
Go back real quick to on the topic of the scanning the for social network use and everything. Where I was going with my point ends up ultimately with what the other guys were saying, is that this creates a system where you can detect people who are the point was not about catching terrorists, it's about finding nonconformists, and then the reverse of that is knowing like there's certain social media things that I have used in the past. And I don't talk about certain things because I know that those things are that I am being profiled. And so that is one of the things. And you go back to being able to scan. When you see a soldier who gets online and he starts talking about, well, I don't think that this is right about this or that. And you can start flagging people who are not kissing the asses of their commanders and everything, and they want to know about this, and people report them now, and they can get this stuff on their record. But as soon as you see this stuff, you know, it flags it. So I mean, I agree the stuff that you guys are saying on that. Now, also, now, real quick on the Facebook thing, it reminds me so much of go back to 1995, and you had the same problem when AOL was mailing out these floppy disks and CD-ROMs to hundreds of millions of people. And I remember having to constantly tell people that America Online is not the internet, even though you could get an email address that worked over the internet system and you could do some browsing and the like. It was this closed system, and everybody thought, oh, I'm on the internet, because they were on America Online. So it's the same type of thing right now. I think that the fact that they're expanding and getting billions of users, it doesn't necessarily mean that the internet is dying. They're just getting billions of new users into a new system. I think there's one important thing that a lot of people don't understand about Facebook is that what the power of Facebook is not the corporation that's there. It's not the wall posts and the whole Facebook experience that happens. Because there's many other types of systems out there before it that even, you know, had better interfaces or whatever. And even right now, the power of it is that it's turned into what Facebook is it is a single access directory server with recommendations of friends that keep popping up on your screen. You can easily find someone, you see their photo, and you add them. So you don't have to go out and say, contact someone and find out what's your email address and try to remember it and then write it down. And then that changes, and then they got to get yours. It's a single place you log in, and then instantaneously you have access to everybody. So it won't, not that it's an easy solution, but being able to create an alternate distributed system where you can have instant access to everyone very fast. It's not an easy solution. It's similar to the problem of like key servers and how do I get someone's key, and using a centralized system to send encrypted message back and forth is easier than doing key distribution. It's the same as with email exchanges. Is that in the future, if alternate systems come up with ways that you can have a similar system where you log on and you can contact, and contacts are exchanged easily of friends and associates and everything, and done in a private way, Facebook can go the way of other bankrupt corporations. It's just they happen to have the niche edge on it right now, and that could be replaced because there's no real magic to it except for that single directory.
The real magic is actually in people using it. That's where the real magic comes from. People don't use Facebook because it's the greatest thing around, but because their friends are on Facebook, and because you're looked upon when you're not on Facebook or Facebook or whatever the crap name is. So the problem here with all the Facebook campaigning is actually that most people behave already as if Facebook is the majority of the internet. Recently, I sat at the airport and looked around the people, you know, around me, what they were doing on their mobile phones and tablets and whatever. Like 99% of them were on Facebook at the moment I looked. You know, that was what they used the internet for. And I think that there are only about 100 websites total that constitute what the vast majority, like above 90% of the internet users, go to regularly, if at all.
Yeah, what I'm scared of is that my ISP will do something like trying to set up my new Android phone, where at some point of setting up, going through the setup menus on this Android phone, I was convinced that I was going to have to get a Facebook account or set up some sort of Facebook account for the darn phone to work. That's how integrated it is in there. I'm afraid my ISP is going to do the same thing, and where, you know, they're going to push me toward Facebook everything as the internet, and you know, have no concept of other ports and other services running.
The main source for new Facebook users when it comes to people being pushed into Facebook is actually third parties that run internet services, internet websites, web applications, whatever, that require Facebook for signing up. So you need a Facebook account to log into their system, to sign up with their system. And that is probably the biggest grasp Facebook has on the whole market right now.
Yeah, it sounds like the government real ID put into digital form, but, you know, run by the corporate.
Well, they're using it in order to vet people so that they can filter out sock puppets and people making multiple accounts and things of that nature. And it's a cheap way of doing it. Many people use Google for the same reason. Is, you know, Google requires in many cases that you vet yourself with a mobile phone number to receive a message. And so because of that, many companies hop on to Google in order to use it as a means to filter out people who they don't want in their system.
Right, and that is exactly the real problem, as Cyril already said, is that Facebook and Google and whatever are not just media sites or social networks or whatever, they are identity providers these days. And it's probably just a few years until the governments of the world decide, hey, let's outsource the whole stuff to Facebook.
Speaking of that, Reuters reports that 20 of the 47 countries scored by Freedom House for Internet Freedom declined in their rankings for January 2011. Pakistan, Bahrain, and Ethiopia saw the biggest rollbacks in internet freedom. Estonia topped Freedom House's list for greatest internet freedoms, followed by the United States, but it's in decline. As in Russia, where government actors recently passed a law that can only be enforced through deep packet inspection and dragnet, the reasons given for internet restrictions in all nations center around the four horsemen of the infopocalypse, but in practice end up being suppression of political speech. Smuggler, the reasons for implementing restrictions on internet freedoms are obvious. If government actors could roll back time, they would have outlawed the internet for sure. But since they can't put the worm back in the can, what do they have to do to enact these laws that they're trying to pass, and what countertech is available?
Well, they have to do pretty little to enforce those laws, because most of those laws are enforced by companies for them. So essentially, you write on a piece of paper saying this and this is forbidden, and the internet provider or website or Facebook or whoever is liable if the law is broken. So everybody is rushing to implement methods to flag content or similar. And the other thing is going to the ISPs and telling the ISPs to install blocking systems for DNS blocks, for example, or black routing certain IP addresses, which is one of the things that Russia is doing right now. They're having a blacklist of websites that they don't want anyone to reach anymore. So that will result in DNS blocks or IP blocks, most likely. And there's the issue of circumventing these things. And there's the issue of some content on a website being illegal, while other content should not be blocked. And that is where a deep package inspection comes in, which is essentially a method to look into the packages sent between the computers and also reassemble the streams to gather information about what has been sent, who's talking, keywords, for example, or certain video content, or even stuff like finding out protocols just by looking for a protocol fingerprint, and blocking things like Tor or I2P or Bitcoin that might not be wanted by the government to exist.
So, Hiro, what kind of countertech can we have to keep our access open?
Well, I mean, you have the if you start off with the first implementation of this stuff, you know, many times you can get around it by using a VPN or something. But sometimes they, with the DPI, they can detect that you're using a VPN and actually block it. But that's all technical stuff. It's more about the next level after that will be legal. So where they would say that to just similar to like DMCA, where many times the crime is not in copying, but it's in circumventing the anti-copy technology itself as a crime. So if it becomes widespread, people circumventing these systems with systems like Tor or VPNs or SSH tunnels or other types of tunneling technology to get around the inspection of each of individual packets themselves, of the websites they're visiting and traffic. They can pass a law which basically says that using censorship circumvention technology itself is illegal. And at that point, you're basically screwed, because the moment that you're on the network, if you try to do something to hide, they detect that, and then you're screwed for circumventing it. So the next level would be private networks, where people are running alternate networks that are not even hooked up with the ones on the government. Of course, that can be made illegal also. So, I mean, there's, as far as circumvention techs, a lot of it just depends on how far the government's willing to go to prosecute those who are not using the mainstream systems.
How about bombing the internet NAPs so that you knock down the entire internet?
Well, then the censorship is complete.
Yes, but when you put them out of business, then the alternative systems have a way to grow because they don't have competition.
I kind of find that strategy horrific.
Well, I'm an extremist, as you know.
Where would I get my cat pictures?
Yeah, well, even running the secondary networks, or running networks that aren't connected to the internet themselves, that's not a grandma-friendly solution. Who's working on solutions to this these days? Because everything seems to be, the Tor and I2P and Bitcoin seem to be included in the internet in a suitcase, and that's Hillary Clinton's ballywick. Hopefully Hillary Clinton's not the one that's going to save me from internet restrictions, is she?
Well, there
no,
are
she won't help you.
Yeah. Well, there are people working on alternative internets. Almost all of them are Wi-Fi based, or a similar technology expanded perhaps with amateur radio type of signaling or capabilities. But those things are coming along, actually. I'm not sure they're going to reach the point where they're plug and play, but if they do, they could start to route around a lot of the internet locally.
Well, the problem really with all those access restriction methods is that they're not running locally. They're targeting mostly things that are international or interregional. So you still need, with all mesh nets and everything we might have in the future or currently already, we still have an issue of international communication. And my personal take on that is, I look forward to a world that is covered by people running around with suitcases of data, and we call it FidoNet 3.
Yep.
Yeah, there you go. I think also another thing that if you look at this from the perspective of, how can a couple of people have internet freedom while they're living inside of a totalitarian society, if you just look at it like that, you're kind of screwed, So, but if you start to see how or similar situations have happened in the past with the black market, and that's similar to this suitcase type idea, but not technically, but from a circumvention standpoint, is that similar to like Bitcoin? If you say, how can two people exchange money and value between each other without having to use the Federal Reserve or some of these other systems that are co-opted with the governments? You have to come up with a system or technology where there's a sufficient number of people who are using them that are bypassing it, regardless of what the particular regime actually wants. So, like with Bitcoin, let's say if it was made illegal and there were still billions of people that were using it, you see that there's a somewhat of an irrelevance that starts taking place just by the mere fact of the market itself demanding something that has been forbidden. So,
one thing that I do want to point out is that we're talking about this dichotomy of a single global internet network versus local mesh nets and similar things. And there's a bunch of applications that would be served just fine by a mesh net that serves, a community of a couple hundred people as compared to a whole global internet. You could think of like a dorm with people sharing files inside it, or a co-op with 100 members, and they need some scheduling software to figure out who does the dishes, who weeds the Weeds the Garden. And within that local community, you could easily fulfill all those with a single shard of a CJDNS system or something like that. And I mean, even if they can't communicate to the outside world, they can still get a lot done. Like Smuggler, you're talking about all the people using Facebook at the airport, but many of them, I mean, they're only really using Facebook to talk to like a dozen friends. So if you can get, you know, your friend group onto some sort of alternate network, you can do the same stuff that you would without involving the internet.
Well, the real magic of the internet is not that people can run a network. The real magic of the internet is that it spans the globe and that you can talk with a friend who's 100 kilometers or 100,000 kilometers away. Well, with planetary internet. But the problem really that we face if those attack scenarios become a reality, and it seems like they become, is that we have to make sure that our protocols work with fragmented networks and potentially enormous latencies. And that is where a lot of our stuff currently is not prepared to deal with. If you take Bitcoin and you fragment the network of miners, you'll have a big issue. If you take Bitcoin and you introduce a latency of several days, you get an issue. So what you need to do with our protocols is not just have different pipes that replace the current system, but have a different thought about how to deal with data and with applications so that we can live with fragmentation and latency. And that really means that we have to bring intelligence back to the client and not put it everything on the internet and into the cloud, because there we might lose it.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, it seems that if you have these islands of internet, Balkanized internet, that you almost have a result that's similar to the bum sitting around the campfire at the end of Fahrenheit 451. It's a high-tech version of it. I think that, as Smuggler said, really, the internet works because it's international. So something has to be developed that provides that capability. Now, the fragmented stuff with Wi-Fi certainly is going to work that way. However, recently, Osman, I think his name is, has moved ahead, and he has, under HackRF, produced a transceiver which should be shipping anytime now, maybe this month, for around $300. And it allows you to receive and transmit on any frequency from, I believe, maybe 60 to 100 megahertz to 6 gigahertz. At least that's the plan. And operates with bandwidths up to about 10 megahertz simultaneously. So that is a really cool thing. And it's an SDR, software design radio, which means that it's all open, the design of the hardware and the software. And I think that this could be the beginning of something very significant. Also significant is the money for it actually came from the U.S. Department of Defense.
Of course. Hey, Wise Guy, make sure we get a link to that for the show notes. Before we move on to our last topic, I'd like to thank the panelists and their sponsors. Smugglers brought to you by Enerplex.net and Shadowlife.cc. And the real magic of Reality Exploit Roundtable is that Smuggler has now said the real magic 4 times. Hero White's the host of Cypherpunked and the Agorist Social Club and co-host Coinbase with Plato. You can hear all those shows on agoristradio.com, which of course hosts the Reality Exploit Roundtable, and you can get in contact with Plato via Reddit or Twitter as The Real Plato. Whoever wants to claim Wise Guy, leave us a comment in the show notes. And if you're looking for agorist businesses, there's no better place than blackandyellowpages.com. If you have an agorist business and you'd like to list it on Black and Yellow Pages, send me an email at voodoo@blackandyellowpages.com, and I'll send you an invite so you can set up your own free listings. Let's move on to campaign data mining. According to the New York Times, strategists affiliated with Obama and Romney campaigns say they have access to information about the personal lives of voters at a scale never before imagined. They're using their data to influence voting habits, in effect to train voters to go to the polls through subtle cues, rewards, and threats in a manner akin to the marketing efforts of credit card companies and big box retailers. In the weeks before Election Day, millions of voters will hear from callers with surprisingly detailed knowledge of their lives. These callers, Friends of friends or long-lost work colleagues will identify themselves as volunteers for the campaigns or independent political groups. The callers get their information from tracking cookies, commercial data aggregators, credit reporting agencies, and social media. Here's Sasha Eisenberg, author of The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, on this data mining.
So in the wake of 2000, I think a lot changes. You have all sorts of new data coming from the commercial world that's making its way into politics. You have academics in political science discovering field experiments. Political science had never spent anywhere near as much time as some of the other social sciences actually testing things in the field. Mm-hmm. People realize they can run these experiments and see what actually moves voters. And we start to realize that a lot of things we see in polls or in focus groups don't really live up to the way that people experience politics in the real world.
So this combination of commercial data and political data, give me an example.
Well, you know, for you, Hari, you're a registered voter, so right away I know on your voter registration record if you're affiliated with a party, which elections you voted in, if you vote in primaries. I know your date of birth, so I know your age, I know your gender, in some states I know your race. I have all sorts of political information maybe from other groups or campaigns that have contacted you in the past, so I know that somebody from John Kerry's campaign knocked on your door 8 years ago and you told them you weren't interested in voting, or you told them you care about the environment. All of that is in a database somewhere. Maybe, you know, Planned Parenthood knocked on your door, or the NRA too, and that information exists somewhere. And then there's all this information that's been gathered by commercial data warehouses from magazine subscriptions, the things you put on warranty forms. A lot of it first gathered by people who are creating credit ratings. Mm-hmm. They obviously want to know as much about you as possible and develop predictions. What's happened in the political world is people are doing statistical models with the same goal. So instead of predicting whether you're likely to default on your loan or pay off your bill on time or run up $500 on your credit card in a given month, they're trying to predict how likely are you to vote in November. Who are you likely to vote for? What issues are you likely to care about?
Wise guy, politicking is, of course, a science, and political operatives have used the latest and greatest marketing techniques and propaganda throughout history. That's why they get paid the big bucks. But do you think there's a line that politicians won't cross, including this data, or has that line already been crossed?
Yes, I think the Rubicon has already been crossed. What we're witnessing here is what I consider a second revolution in U.S. electioneering. In the first revolution, beginning in the 60s, as that was mentioned in that piece, the U.S. political campaigns changed from a traditional approach where politicians created platforms which reflected their beliefs and their ideology. They delivered stump speeches with their messages, and their staff tried to guess what the voters considered important. These were transformed into a fine art using the then new marketing techniques of surveys and focus groups. And within a few years, most politicians had abandoned any pretext of telling voters a consistent story about what they really thought, into the now familiar smarmy speeches in which they tell each targeted group what they want to hear. The result are now the now familiar debates in which each candidate tries to point out the often obvious inconsistencies in their rhetoric. Voters are now much less likely to know anything of substance about the candidates and how they might really conduct themselves in office. Well, now comes the second revolution. Now, unlike the previous elections where the campaign analysts had mostly only location and voter registration information, now they have lots of consumer data about you, and they're able to combine this with your online browsing data, what sites you view, where you get your news, what you buy online, the magazines you subscribe to, where and what type of vacations you take. So their methods have gone from an art to a science. And this mined data is analyzed now by these sophisticated algorithms, and piece mentioned, they really can paint a very detailed picture about the person that you are. So should we be afraid of this technology? That depends very much generationally. If you live your life on Facebook, you've probably already revealed much more about you than these campaigns collect, and you may be very sorry someday when your all-too-public exploits become a millstone for future employment, personal relationships, or make you the target by government agencies. If you're generally more private, as most of us on here are, then indeed these revelations should be a wake-up call and move you to take matters into your own hands to restrict the flow of this data and prevent leaving lots of breadcrumbs for data mining. So I think that they're going to take this as far as they possibly can until they get pushback, like Facebook has done several times when it tried changing its terms of services ex post facto with little consultation with their users. So that's my answer in the short.
Okay, Plato, there's a push. And I don't know, I can't describe it as a strong push, but I will say the people doing it are motivated individuals. And most recently I heard a interview with a professor from the University of Iowa, and it was this push to get people to vote no matter what. It doesn't matter who they vote for, it doesn't matter what they, you know, why they vote, just that they vote. And it was a complete, we've got to have the consent of the governed, and they show that consent by voting. And in fact, they want to push for mandatory voting laws. How can we and should we be countering movements like that?
Well, I guess first off, his motivation could simply be that he, like the guys who are trying to get everybody to vote, maybe they are just doing it ideologically. Maybe they think that, voting is the only right you have. It's the only possible way for you to control your life. Why the hell would you not vote? Of course you got to vote. It, you know, could be more nefarious. Maybe he wants to get your personal info. Who knows? I mean, the day that mandatory voting laws get passed is going to be a sad day for, well, I'm in America, but that just really scares me, the idea of not even being able to not consent in a...
Smuggler, there are some countries in Europe that have mandatory voting laws, don't they?
Yeah, but I'm very successful in denying them access to my mind, so I don't remember their names.
Australia has that law.
Well, several countries propose that all over and all over again. And of course, if they force you, either you pay the fine, if it's just a fine, or you make your ballot void. You know, I mean, you can shit on it, you can spray on it, you can draw a nice picture on it, you can give it to your daughter, which will clean up the dog poo with it, I don't care, void it. And actually, there's not much more you can do about it, because democracy is really a totalitarian system.
You know, I like those ideas. Those are some excellent ways to say that you don't consent in a somewhat more subtle way.
Yeah, but Hero, aren't they going to do just like the none of the above votes here, not even report them? If you spoil your ballot, they're just going to act like, well, a ballot was cast, so that must be consent.
Yeah, it's exactly what they'll do. And it's essentially what happens now in the United States with the Electoral College. You can vote for whoever you want, but if you did not get a majority in that state, you're not even mentioned as having received the vote, because the only votes that are counted are the electoral votes. But back to the voting thing, there's two things with that I want to bring up. Many years ago, I read a book had run across by happen chance in a foreign country in English called The Self-Legitimizing Identities. It's published by, like, I think it was Oxford Press or whatever, and there's many mentions of writings by was it Hoppe on the democracy, that God that failed, and like, and they talked about that, how people tend to focus on democracy and monarchy and all these things as being the systems where people, they put themselves in the power, and they say, well, like some of the old systems was, you know, God came down and legitimate and instituted this institution of the king, and therefore the king is the hand of God on earth or whatever. And there's all these legitimizing themes that come up for these systems. Well, when they came out with democracy, a lot of people think, oh, well, the person that becomes in the power, the king has to legitimize. The king now is the president, or the oligarchy, however they get themselves elected and in power. And the focus of this book was not so much on the processions and the palaces and the presidential car and the presidential planes and all these rituals that they go through. They said that there's also the reverse of that, which is necessary for democracy, and that is the voting. And so the voting is a way for a person to legitimize their particular form of tyranny. Or it's a way that the system itself creates a ritual for the individual to think that they have legitimized these particular powers that are up there. So there, if you have mandatory voting, you're also doing sort of a little mind trip thing with the people, even if it's subtle and not very direct, but it does have that. So that everyone, that if they're forced to actually make a decision, then at some point they have accepted and have legitimized themselves as citizens and legitimized the powers that are there. And then, of course, with citizenship comes all these other obligations, which would be like paying taxes and the like. Now, there's another thing in here, too. I've noticed this thing. It's interesting you brought this thing up about how there's been this push about going to vote. I've noticed it from even some people that I know that are very partisan. They're like, you know, get out and vote, vote, vote. It doesn't matter. You know, as a citizen, you know, you need to go vote. And I'm thinking to myself, are they really saying that? Even if I would vote for, you know, the Communist Party, there's this idea that there's virtue in voting. I mean, you could claim some type of virtue in who you're voting for, or against, possibly, at some level. But to actually say that there's virtue in voting itself is where's the virtue in actually doing that? And so I ran across an article linked off of Mises or Lou Rockwell a week ago or so, and they were talking in there about this Leninist ideology and about the party line, and in the Soviet Union, and I guess in China and some other places where they still have this party system, that one of the core philosophies is that the proper path to take is not up to the individual. The only proper path that can take is through the decision of the actual party itself. Therefore, the collective decision itself reveals truth. Okay, truth is revealed through the collective decision, and I think that ties into this idea with it doesn't matter what you do, go out there and vote. It's like this mystical thing, like the ultimately the path that we should take, and the only path, the actual moral path itself, is going to be decided by the fact is if we get enough people out there to vote, we will know the decision. That's what it seems that these people are saying, and that goes right back to this party, the idea of the party decision being the revelation of truth.
Well, that's all we need to say about voting in politics on Reality Exploit Roundtable, because that's all the time we have for Reality Exploit Roundtable episode 12. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and invite you to join in the conversation on the Pound Agora IRC channel on enterplex.net. Thanks to Smuggler, Wise Guy, Plato, and Hero for joining me today. Links to the topics we discussed can be found in the show notes at agorastradio.com, as well as archives of previous Reality Exploit Roundtables. Thank you for listening to Reality Exploit Roundtable episode 12.
Just because I'm tired of Barack Obama and Mitt Romney.
That's why you're crying? Oh, it'll be over soon, Abby. Okay? The election will be over soon, okay?
Okay.